there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome and thanks for joining us. I just got off the Skype phone with Lu Zhang to talk about her new book, Inside China's Automobile Factories, The Politics of Labor and Worker Resistance. This came out with Cambridge University Press in 2015. Now, it's a rather extensive interview, so I'll keep this short, but I'll just say that this is a really interesting book for anybody with a deep and abiding interest in either labor relations and worker conditions more generally, or modern China specifically. So what Lu Zhang does is she takes us into seven large automobile assembly factories spread across a bunch of cities in China, and she opens up kind of a window into not just labor conditions, labor mobilization practices, but also the emergence of what she calls a labor force dualism, wherein there are actually kind of two tiers of workers in these factories, a more semi-permanent kind of regular set of workers, and then a large and growing class, and a very hybrid kind of a class of temporary workers, who include workers who get their jobs through temp agencies, students who are on internships, and a lot of other kinds of people who are often working full-time, but not gaining any kind of job security as a result of that. So the result of this bipartite kind of dualistic labor structure is increasing worker unrest, but also really interesting opportunities to mobilize. So she takes us into a couple of different instances of worker strikes. She talks about the kinds of grievances that emerge in these different communities of workers and the recourses that they have or not to deal with these grievances. And also, by the end of the book, point us forward to suggest some ways that this all might resolve or turn out in the years ahead. So it's really interesting, and I recommend it for anybody who's interested, again, in kind of labor politics, in histories of workers, or anybody who wants a kind of localized perspective on the kinds of conversations we've been having about labor and different sort of structures of labor in the academy, which you'll hear by the end of the interview she actually speaks to, and she relates to this context in China. So thanks very much for listening. I hope you enjoy, and I'll see you soon. I'm here today to talk with Lu Zhang about her new book, Inside China's Automobile Factories. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Lu, and thanks very much for navigating the setting up process and for making time to talk with me today. I'm really looking forward to it.
Hi, Carla. Thank you so much for having me. I'm very delighted to be here.
So, Lu, can you start us off, as is traditional for the channel, by talking a little bit about how you came to the field, and specifically, what brought you to work on the sociology of China?
I was born and grew up in China in the reform era. So my mother, she used to work at a state-owned textile printing and dyeing factory when I was very young. And she would take me to work and put me in the daycare facility provided by the factory for its employees on site. So in a sense, I kind of encountered the factory environment from very early on in my life. And so I became interested in labor studies when I was an undergraduate student majoring in sociology at Fudan University in Shanghai. In my junior year, I got involved in a research project with one of my sociology professors on the life and work experience of migrant workers in Shanghai. So we were asked to observe and talk to migrant workers. After witnessing the plight and the daily coping strategies of migrant workers in the flourishing metropolitan Shanghai, I can't help asking why there is persistent inequality and discrimination against certain individuals and groups in the labor markets and at work. Mm-hmm. So I went on to pursue a master's degree in comparative labor studies and social research methods at the University of Warwick in UK, where I also began reading some classic works in industrial sociology and labor process theory under the Marxist tradition. After that, I decided to further pursue my PhD in sociology at Johns Hopkins University in the United States, where some of the most imaginative and engaging Marxist and world system labor scholars enlightened me with a historical and a global approach to study labor and labor movements. At Hopkins, I started doing research on the Chinese auto workers when studying labor unrest in the world automobile industry with Professor Beverly Saver. That led to my dissertation and eventually this book. So it's a combination of my family and also personal growing experience.
Great. Thank you so much. Now, you've already introduced it a little bit, right? The book is a study of labor resistance in automobile factories in China. And you've talked a little bit about how you came to the topic, and thank you for that. You've also mentioned that this began its life as a dissertation. So can you talk a little bit about that transition from dissertation to book? Were there any major transformations in the project, any major changes in the way you were thinking about your own process or methodology, or really kind of any notable elements for you about that transformation from one form to another?
Yeah, that's a great question. Because I think for many of us, the first book tend to be usually from the dissertation. So it has been a long process after you're working so many years on a subject. And sometimes you got lost about what most exciting thing at the beginning, like excited you to study the subject. I talked to a few editors about the subject, they always the first question they ask me would be, so just give me one or two sentences, what's the most exciting thing about the subject? So I think the idea is the dissertation, I try to detail everything I know about what I studied and what my fieldwork, and I try to put to show that I really master the field. Mm-hmm. But the book is a book to for people to read, right? To appeal to the readers. What are some things that are really in the way that have your own voice to tell the readers the story, and also in an academic book in a systematic theoretical way. So the first thing, the big difference between the dissertation and the book is actually get rid of the literature review chapter. So the introduction become the kind of my fieldwork experience and what they spoke about, and also kind of inviting the readers to come along with me to explore the inside life, the factory life of the workers, and to get inside the automobile factories. So I would say this is a transition that not only from dissertation to a book, but also for myself is from a graduate students to a scholar, to have your independent voice and also to have a outside angle to kind of get out of the box and to look at what this book is really about and why it matters and how I want to convey what kind of message I want to convey through the book to a broader field and audience.
Thank you. Really beautifully put. Thank you so much. So you talked a little bit about your fieldwork, and the research for the book actually encompassed fieldwork in many senses, right? You talk about fieldwork on the shop floors of automobile factories, interviews, and also archival research. So for the book, you describe spending 20 months of ethnographic research inside 7 large auto assembly factories in 6 different cities in China over a period between 2000 2004 and 2011, spending at least 2 months in each factory. So this is a pretty substantial amount of ethnographic fieldwork. Now, you talk in the introduction about how you gained access to these factories in the first place. This is not something that's very easy to do, and I just mention this for listeners because this is a really interesting part of the story itself. So could you talk a little bit about your experiences in getting access to these factories for us, and also kind of what a typical day, if there was such a thing, right, on the factory floor may have been like for you?
Okay. Getting access to those large automobile factories is not easy. As many of us who have done field work in China, it often requires a combination of personal connections, right? You have to know somebody. The persistent efforts, just keep on trying, and good luck. Many times, there's a lot of uncertainty about field work access. So I began my field work in June 2004. 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago, by getting access to a state-owned truck maker located in my hometown. My uncle, who was a good friend of a senior manager at the plant, he helped me to secure access to the factory. So I was introduced to manager Benjamin as a Chinese graduate student who is studying in the United States and is doing field work for her dissertation on human capital and management in the Chinese auto industry. With hindsight, I realized the fact that I was introduced by a senior manager, combined with the state purpose of my research, led to the expectation among managers that my research would produce a positive outcome and be a potential benefit to the factory. Although this perception facilitated my access to and interviews with managers, it also caused a suspicion among workers, such that it took me quite a while to gain their trust. So my initial request to work on the line with ordinary workers was immediately turned down by management out of the consideration for my safety and the high physical demand involved in automobile production. And my small size as a female researcher further justify such concerns. So instead, I was assigned to the factory party committee office to help in collecting shop floor material and editing factory newsletters aimed at promoting model workers and advanced production teams to boost worker morale. So it's actually very interesting to me that all the factories I visited, I studied, whether those are state-owned factories or joint ventures, they all have a factory party committee office that have multiple functions, including editing newsletters and promoting this kind of workplace morale. So this position allowed me to hang around shop floors freely and talk to workers when they were not working. But I have to admit that, that's why I didn't say that this is a participant observation, because I actually didn't have a chance to work as a worker online. It's observations, but it's not participant observations. I did got the firsthand kind of insight about how the factory work is organized, how the daily life is like. So I'm going to get to that in a minute. Just to finish a kind of how I gained workers' trust this process. At the beginning, workers were both suspicious and curious about my presence on the shop floor. They either refrained from talking to me or asked me a lot of questions about myself and my dissertation project. Before I could even ask them any questions, I had to constantly explain my research goals and reassure workers that I was neither hired nor paid by management. I could tell that the workers were puzzled and amazed by the fact that I, a young female graduate student who grew up locally and went abroad to pursue a PhD in sociology, would choose to spend months in the factory trying to write about Chinese auto workers and their everyday work life. So I remember a question I often received was, "What are there anything interesting?" So like workers would say, "谁会感兴趣中国工人的那个生活？就是说, who cares about workers' life?" Nothing interesting about, as time went by, some workers began talking to me. As one worker later told me, they started to see me as a sincere and hardworking student who would like to listen to their trivial stories and complaints for hours, with great interest. And I can also feel, the kind of appreciation, from workers that, when someone they really care about their lives, their story, and really pay attention, listen to them, that kind of that can feel this kind of a mutual over time. This this mutual trust gradually when it's actually very kind of to me that once. Workers open up to you, they will tell you a lot of things. And so I gradually gained their trust as time, at the same time. So by relying on this kind of a semi-structured interview techniques with a sympathetic and a patient ear, I was able to establish rapport with workers and get them to open up and to share with me their stories, aspirations, and emotions. So, yeah, so for about two, yeah, go ahead.
No, go. I was going to say, no, go on, please.
Yeah, okay. So for about two months from June 2004 and September 2006, I went to work at this state-owned truck factory every day. A typical day started from the from 7:30 a.m. Pre-shift work group meeting, and getting off at 6 p.m. with the day shift workers. There were also night shift workers, but I pretty much did the day shift because I was working for the party. A factory party committee office. So their regular working hours is pretty much the daytime. So I observed how production was organized. So 7:30, the meeting lasts 15 minutes, 10 to 15 minutes. And then workers would prepare, set up the tools, prepare for the production. The production started at 8 a.m. Sharp, and then during there was a 10 minutes break in the morning, maybe around 10:30, and then there's a half an hour lunch break between 12 and 12:30. There was another 10 to 15 minutes break in the afternoon until. The day shift was over at 6 p.m. So it was a long day. So, I got to observe how production was organized, what the working conditions were, how people interacted with one another, and what kind of exchange took place on a daily basis. For example, as I talk in the book, there was a lot of like after bargaining and kind of also workers trying to beat up the lines, you know, kind of the game doing some. So I was able to get those from hanging around the shop floor and also talk to workers. I also ate in the factory cafeteria with workers and visited their dormitories and home after work. I rarely use a tape recorder because I noticed it tend to make people feel nervous and self-conscious while talking to me if I use the recorder, except for formal speeches given by factory leaders on a few occasions. For researchers, I wrote down the daily work routines that I consider meaningful while observing them or immediately afterwards, such as pre-shift work group meetings held by team leaders and workers' conversations during work breaks and lunchtime. So I typed down everything every night after the work, so that try to as accurate as possible. I also collected relevant factory files, including statistics on production employees, work rules and regulations, and internal newsletters and references. Mm-hmm.
So the really interesting thing, or one of the really interesting things about the book, is that these very detailed experiences at the level of individual bodily participation, at least in the life of the factory and the workers, allowed you to step out and make some really broad and really, I think, interesting arguments about labor practice and about the Chinese state more generally. So I'll just kind of set the stage a little bit and bring us into that, and then we can work our way through some of the chapters. So the book argues that widespread grassroots protests among auto workers in China have succeeded on some level. And this is important to note because this is actually in contradistinction to what some other studies have suggested. So these protests have won workers' wage increases and improved conditions on the shop floor, among other things. Now, despite the fact that labor unrest is localized and arguably apolitical, it's nonetheless, as you show in the book, pressured the government into enacting new labor laws and policy changes. And as we get through to the later parts of the book, we'll talk about some of those policy changes. Now, the book explores an underlying contradiction between two kinds of forces, what you call legitimacy and profitability, characterizing capitalist development. Put another way, attempts to resolve a crisis of profitability can tend to create or to exacerbate, as you put it, a crisis of social legitimacy and vice versa. Okay, so then after laying this out, you take us into the basic context of the growth of China's auto industry in the past 20 years. So I'm just going to lay this out super quickly so that listeners have a context within which to situate what's going to come next. So we see over the past 20 years massive foreign investment and an increased scale and concentration of work. There's a creation of a new generation of auto workers with increased bargaining power that comes along with this. There's also now the entering of China into a global competition in the mass production of autos at a stage when that global competition was actually really, really high and profit margins were really, really narrow. As a consequence, the state restructured industry and increased competition since the late 1990s, and this forced Chinese automakers to move toward what you call a leaner and meaner work regime. And the result for auto workers has meant increased intensity of work, reduced job security, stagnant wages, a lack of opportunities for advancement, and an inferior status in a very hierarchical factory social order. So that's basically, just to kind of set the stage, and the first and the second chapter really lay this out really beautifully. Now, integral to understanding this and integral to understanding the arguments of the book is the notion of labor force dualism. And this is where I'm going to hit the ball back to you, Lou. So you talked a lot about the emergence of labor force dualism as a central component of labor relations in lots of large capital intensive enterprises since the early to mid 2000s. And this sort of labor dualism is absolutely central to understand everything that's going on in the book. So with that, can you talk about labor force dualism in the context of auto workers? What is it? What are the different levels of labor? And why is this so important for us to understand?
Yeah, thank you for the excellent question. And for the great kind of layout of the book, I think you really got the kind of the key to like my central kind of questions I try to address. This labor force dualism is one of the key mechanisms discussed in the book. And by labor force dualism, I refer to a labor control strategy that draws boundaries between formal regular workers and temporary workers. By this term, I refer to this control mechanism that deploys formal and temporary workers side by side on production lines, having them perform similar or identical tasks, but subjecting them to different treatment. Formal workers have higher wages, better benefits, and relatively secure employment as part of the management efforts to gain their cooperation. In contrast, temporary workers have lower wages, fewer benefits, and little job security. As students of China labor and more generally know, this is not something new. We know that this kind of using the treating workers, different group workers, differently and drawing boundaries among workers is a consistent strategy. Both in under capitalism and also in under socialism. So Andrew Wilder and also Elizabeth Perry have been talking about this fragmentation and divisions within workers, and we know the state-owned companies had the practice in the mall area under state socialism by using temporary workers as well. So in part that I'm actually try to trace this continuity and the change in terms like the labor force dualism, but also I'm engaging with this larger debate in the field to understand this dialectic relations between worker solidarity and intra-class divisions within the working class, and as well as this boundary drawing strategy by the state, by capitalists, and sometimes by workers themselves, this kind of intertwined dynamics of class-based and status-based mobilization, or we say movements and counter-movements. So that's just kind of a theoretical background. But get back to this dualism more specifically. This dualism in the auto industry was introduced in the 1990s, as a solution to lowering cost and increase flexibility by hiring temps, at the same time trying to gain consent and cooperation from former workers. Under this background that you have just mentioned to the readers, with the competition increased and the profitability become thinner, and there's a drive towards meaner and leaner workplace. But at the same time, the industry still under the state, and the state has more intervention in the auto assembling sector. So there is requirement for management to keep a peaceful and a cooperative workforce. So that's why you see this tension between profitability and legitimacy, particularly accurate in this particularly those large auto assembling factories. Mm-hmm. However, this dualism carries notable unintended consequences. For one, the management construct division among workers has become a continuous source of irritation and impetus for a new generation of temporary workers who are increasingly urban and better educated to protest against unequal treatment. To the extent that assembling plants are able to provide job security at relatively higher wages for core labor force, they push down job insecurity and cost-cutting measures, either to their part suppliers, like part workers, right, part workers, or by constructing this dualism within the assembling plants. So as a result, it's not a coincidence that the main source of militancy has so far resided among part workers in the subcontracting system and among temporary workers in the assembling plants. But under this highly integrated just-in-time production system, the strikes at part suppliers and by temporary workers, they can effectively shut down the assembling plants and the entire production chain, as we see in the case of 2010 auto parts worker strikes that have received wide attention and publicity. So this is the paradox of labor force dualism. Mm-hmm. So I argue the key question concerning the outcome depends on whether a formal and temporary workers are able to make a common cause or they end up fighting against each other, as what we see in the Korea case, the case I mentioned in Chapter 6, compared to the labor force dualism, what they call the two-tier system in the South Korean auto industry, auto sector. And this is conditioned in large measure on how management and the state respond.
Great. Thank you so much. I mean, and a lot of the book really goes into the intricacies and the details of this labor force dualism and introduces us to what are actually some unusual and in some cases very heterogeneous groups of people that fall under these categories of, on the one hand, a formal worker and a temp worker. So as you show in Chapter 3, sort of, you talk about the ways that a typical formal worker and a typical temporary worker might get their job and might get a position at an auto factory. And it turns out that a lot of what we might assume about a typical formal worker turns out to be much more complicated. On the one hand, they're a very, very diverse group. And even though there's a popular assumption about formal workers in this case that they're affluent and contented, you show here that actually many report feeling underpaid. So there's this kind of growing discontentment among formal workers. Also, if we look at temp workers, there's another really interesting set of changes you're pointing out here in this chapter, insofar as there's what you call a flexibilization of this labor system, insofar as there's more and more temp workers being culled from the population of student interns. So student internships, as a result of, you know, vocation and technical education system and work study programs within the VOTEC system in China, are being used as part of the full-time labor force. And also there's a lot of temp agencies that are contributing workers to this temp worker pool. So it's a really interesting transformation of both of these categories that you're showing over the course of this chapter. Now, as we move into the later chapters of the book and into Chapter 4, you're showing us in Chapter 4 kind of transformations in factory conditions that have helped bring about some of the unrest that you describe in detail in the later chapters. Now, you show here that what you call a Taylorist Fordist mass production system has become used and has become sort of put into general use in China's auto factory. So for listeners who aren't familiar with that way of describing a production system, can you take us into briefly what you mean here by a Taylorist Fordist mass production system and what the most important consequences of that approach to mass production have been for workers working in this system?
Taylor is the fourth mass assembling production system, as we know that is typically associated with automobile industry in start from the early 20th century and 19th through the rise of the Fordism, like 1930s and 40s. So this is essentially a mass assembly industry per excellence, and meaning that using the time for the tailor, using the time motion study, and to divide workers' motion and descale that so everyone, every worker just repeat one single task and repeat again and again, but by divide different, so you actually kind of making a human being as a machine, right? You just repeat one motion. And the for just using this mass assembling line to have a large scale, but really the less diversified, like to standardized assembling line, right? And so that you have the capital, kind of you can invest capital intensive and assembly lines and produce a large amount product, so to produce a scale of economy. That's the idea, so mass production, and also Fordism has this meaning about the mass consumption, right? So you have the $5 a day, that's kind of the Ford creation to have this working class become middle class, and also so it has a lot of meaning. But just talk about a technical term about Taylorist Fordist mass assembling production, that's pretty much is associated with considers a scale of the economy, assembling line, and also less flexibility. So it's very rigid. However, since 1960s, 1970s, the Japanese automakers kind of pioneering this just-in-time production. Some call it lean production, as we know it, it's become kind of a trend or a thing since 1970s, 1980s. So today, a typical automobile assembling plants, we will not say that have a large amount stocks built up. Instead, you will say that kind of to minimize inventory, to minimize stock up, but to have this just-in-time delivery system, and also have the flexible line that can produce multiple models, and so that you can satisfy the consumer's diverse demand. So the idea is to maximize efficiency, at the same time to make it more flexible, and so to reduce the waste. So the central idea of lean production is to reduce waste, maximize efficiency. So the combination, however, as I made it clear, so I don't think lean production is a fundamental kind of departure from the mass production, Fordist mass production regime, because it's still based on this large scales of the economy. You have the mass output, right? You also utilize standardization, this method from Taylorist Fordist regime, but at the same time, try to make it more flexible and make it more efficiency. So that's what I call the just-in-time mass production.
And the chapter actually talks about the consequences, right, of this for the workers. And these include long working hours, excessive overtime, intense pace, heavy workloads, and really, and you also talk about the kind of lack, the functional lack or small opportunities for blue-collar workers to actually move up in status in a big auto factory. So all of these collectively produce major worker discontent, and this is something that we see playing out in the next chapters. So chapter 5 focuses on, within this dual labor system, the formal workers, right? And then chapter 5 is going to look at the formal workers. Chapter 6 is going to look at the temporary workers. So in chapter 5, you bring us into the ways that formal workers deal with managerial control and deal with their discontent. Now, when they are dissatisfied, most formal workers, as you show here, don't resort to group coping strategies. They resort instead to individual coping strategies. And you talk about some of the individual coping strategies that they're resorting to over the course of this chapter. Now, there's growing discontent among them. And you show here that they're not just eating this up, right? I mean, they're not just kind of resting on their laurels. They're not just creating an environment of consent, which is the way their approach to dissatisfaction has been painted in some previous work. Instead, you argue that the current state of formal workers is not consent, but instead is something that you call negotiated compliance. So can you introduce that idea briefly for us? What is negotiated compliance, and what's important for us to understand here in order to understand the argument you're making about the formal workers in this chapter?
Yeah, this is a great question. So as you mentioned, the idea is, the workers, especially formal workers in the auto industry, they have higher pay, right? And they have relative job security. So, there was not many reports about worker unrest until in the auto sector until 2010. So people would assume that, you know, they pretty much they are content, right? And so there's some consent among the workers, former workers. However, when I get inside the factory, I notice that workers, they are actually quite aware about what is said in the official manager ideology and what is the reality on the shop floor. But because there are different, first of all, there is a lack of a formal channel, such as a union, right? The independent union for them to bargaining or to express their grievances. So some of them resort to individual strategies, and some using this kind of everyday forms of resistance through effort bargaining, through disruptive ways. And in extreme case, there's strikes. But the idea that negotiated compliance is from this James Scott when he studied the peasants, the everyday forms resistance, he noticed that this concept of hegemony that derived from the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci emphasizes the ideological power of the ruling class to establish and maintain its dominance by persuading the subordinate classes to accept its own worldview and values as common sense. So therefore they can elicit this spontaneous consent, right? But instead, he argued also. So my fieldwork actually confirmed that actually the subordinate class they can interpret, they use the official language or the dominant ideology to advance their demand, their need, or to minimize the negative effects on their daily life. But they don't do this through openly confrontation. Instead, they use the language, they use the kind of the legitimate way a channel, right, to try to turn this around in their for their benefits. So that's when the idea about this legitimacy leverage and this negotiated compliance, so it's a kind of reality led me to this concept that I think I feel this is a more accurate way to capture what is really going on the shop floor. So it's not like workers don't know or they are kind of false consciousness, but rather they utilize a legitimate way promoted by the dominant class, or in this case by management, to minimize the negative effects and to advance their demand through those language and through those symbolic raw material.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you so much. So the whereas Chapter 5 focuses on formal workers and looks at the ways that they're mostly using individual coping strategies, when we turn to Chapter 6 and we turn to the temporary workers, we see rising labor activism here and rising mass movements among temporary workers. So Chapter 6 looks specifically at struggles of temp workers against unequal treatment and against what you call arbitrary management control. Now, they have demonstrated a rising activism in part thanks to a few factors that you lay out in the chapter. So there's a changing social composition, for example. You've already alluded earlier in our conversation to the rising urban nature of temporary workers. They're increasingly urban. They often live together in dorms, and they're very active on social media. And so they're able to use social media to mobilize. As a result of this, you show us that there's more and more opportunity to effectively sort of rise up and be activist and argue for better treatment in cases where, for example, they fail to get paid on time, they have less pay than formal workers, they perceive themselves to have a lack of proper training or opportunities to advance, etc. Now, for you, in thinking about these temporary workers and thinking about the experiences of labor activism among them that you witnessed when you were there for your fieldwork, what for you are some of your most trenchant or some of your most powerful memories of working with and talking to these temporary workers in the midst of talking to them about their concerns and how they were dealing with them through these activist channels? So for you, put another way, what stands out to you most powerfully in terms of your memories of these temporary workers?
Yeah, I think it first struck me about there, as I detail in this chapter, there were a lot of student intern workers who were very young and already in their 18s and 19s, right? And so they stay in the dorms. But so you can, like from the June strike and the October strike I described, there is kind of the process of developing and learning. It's a process of protesting. At the beginning, you can feel that it's kind of the feelings about powerless. There are discussion about being a temp workers and being treated unequally, but it seems that there was nothing you can really change as you have no job security, right? And you can be easily replaced. So this feeling about powerless, I can hear from the conversations. However, at the same time, you can also just kind of the gradual development of the consciousness from their daily work experience. They notice that with such large number of temporary workers, like two-thirds, right, in one group, and if temporary workers stop working, they can shut the whole production line down. There is a gradual transition process as I'm around the workers and I gradually see this kind of idea about the class consciousness developed at the point of production. But at the same time, you can also see this individual sentiments and also this divisions among workers between temporary workers and formal workers. And sometimes the relationship is very complicated. It's not just about the worker brothers. It's also about one group against another group, right? So that's very kind of complicated multiple dimensional nature about this group intra-group relationship. And also I kind of the count by workers from their strike experience. For example, I remember I have the interview calls about the student worker strike. They talk about their feelings, their transformation before strike and after strike. As Hai and Lei reflected, it used to be you went to work hard through your life, went back to your dorm to sleep, and got back to work again. When you did not receive your paycheck on time, or only end half of those former workers for the same work, you just thought there was nothing you could do about it. But suddenly, you realize that you could actually achieve something by coming together and acting together. And the other worker, student worker, said, at that moment of the strike, you feel like we are all staying together. We are all supporting each other. You realize at least I'm not alone. That make you feel stronger. It's a great feeling. So, those kind of, that consciousness, that transition, was happening through the collective actions, through this kind of when workers coming together. So for me, it's kind of very striking also to watch this process and to be kind of a witness about the development of the workers' consciousness as well.
Thank you so much. Now, as we move, was there anything else you wanted to add? I'm sorry.
Well, we can move forward.
We can move forward. So as we move into Chapter 7, you take us into a story about the broader national political context. And this is also the last body chapter before the conclusion. Now, three new labor laws were passed in China by the National People's Congress Standing Committee in 2007. And the most important of these labor laws was something called the Labor Contract Law. Now, you take us into the details of the nature of the law and the forces behind making this labor law in this chapter. Can you maybe, as just a brief window in to understanding this law, talk a little bit about, for you, what was the most important impact or impacts of this law on management decisions and on labor practice at the level of the firm or at the level of the factory?
Yeah. So the labor contract law is a very important law. First of all, it come to stabilize the labor relations to provide from the state policy point to provide more protection for workers based on the written legal contract. So it's a mandates that employers have to have the written contract with workers, right? And the contract, in the sense that we can consider that in previous period without this, even though the labor law passed in 1994 is a big advancement, but there are a lot of workers don't even have a contract, don't have even written contract that make make it very difficult for workers to demand compensation and have their legal rights when there's deep dispute. So the labor contract law is a way to try to stabilize labor relations, also to pacify discontent workers by providing more protection for workers who have a formal contract, right, have a written contract. It also provide more job security for contract workers in the sense that it requires that it states that workers can have the right to demand for unfixed labor contracts after 2 renewals, meaning that those workers can have the what we here we call the job tenure, right? After they have renewed their contract twice. So previously, this is not in the labor law in the 1994 labor law. Workers can request for the unfixed labor contract after 10 years service, but this time it's make it. But it's not employers do not have to, but the labor contract law make it clear that after 2 times renewal, workers are entitled. They can request for this fixed labor contract. But that the direct consequence of that specific clause means for management, they will give their former workers more job security, and it becomes more difficult to fire former contract workers under this new labor contract law. So as a direct consequence, one of the consequences of the labor contract law is after it was implemented, the number of temporary agency workers small than doubled, right? In part because the labor contract law gave more protection to the formal contract workers. But it is still allow employers to use temporary agency workers, which, as I discussed in the chapter, is also kind of a negotiation and a bargaining between the lawmakers and the business or employer interest, as well as considers the labor's interest in this case is a state trade unions or China ACFTU or Federation of China Workers. So that lead to my kind of one of the prediction in the conclusion is we sort of see this entrenched dualism that have management to use more temporary agency workers after the labor contract law was implemented. However, this is not the end of the story because there is a new regulation on the labor dispatch, the temporary agency work, try to give more protection to temporary workers as discussed. So this is going to be the final outcome is still remain to be seen. But we can see this dynamics of dualism still playing and the dynamics of boundary drawing by the state is also evident in this chapter by using the labor laws and the policies to give different kind of differentiation treatment among different groups of workers.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Lou. I think this is a perfect place for us to come to our conclusion. So as you just mentioned, there is also a conclusion, and you led us a little bit into it. And this conclusion considers possible future scenarios of Chinese auto-labor relations. And so I'll just mark that for listeners. We won't really have time to get into it, but you've already spoken a little bit about it. And for listeners who are interested in figuring out how to take these insights that you've given us and think about how to predict possible futures and perhaps how to influence and shape potential policy decisions. The conclusion is the place to look for that. So, Lou, we've talked about a lot of the book, and thank you so much for that. There's, of course, a ton of material that we didn't have a chance to get to. Is there anything in particular that you'd like to mention, especially perhaps for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book?
Yeah, we have covered a lot. I think One thing I want to mention that also related to the central kind of central theme of the dualism I want to touch upon is that today, if we look around, we see that workers everywhere have been confronted with this growing job insecurity and inequality between a shrinking segment of a core regular workers and an ever-expanding population of precarious non-regular workers. A telling example is that we can see the widespread two-tier system in almost every sector, including the higher education, where faculty members are divided between tenure-track professors and non-tenure-track adjuncts and part-time lecturers. I consider a central question for the 21st century labor movements will be the question of finding common ground and building solidarity among workers to struggle for a more just, equitable, and inclusive world, both in the workplace and within our society, in the realm of legal, political, and social rights, targeting as a state. And also I want to mention that by giving voice to workers, I hope to capture this complexity and multi-dimensional nature of working class consciousness and subjectivity. And in many cases, their resistance and actions are not just a way of trying to improve wages and working conditions, although those are important goals, but also a way of gaining a sense of dignity and respect at work. And that is a goal that all the working people across countries, across cultures, they have been struggling for. They have been what we consider a just and democratic workplace. So I think that's it's a goal that deserve everybody to fight for.
Great, thank you so much. So now that the book is out, and congratulations on that, what's next for you? What project is currently occupying you?
So I'm currently working on my second book project that examines the interplay between capital mobility, labor politics, and local development through a detailed comparative case study of geographic relocation and expansion of two electronic multinationals from the Yangtze River Delta to the West China, particularly Chengdu and Chongqing, and also to Vietnam. So in particular, I investigate how are firms' relocation decision informed by labor factors such as cost, worker skills and education levels, labor market conditions, regulations, and also local cultures. So what role do central and local governments and unions play in companies' relocation decisions and process? The third question is, how does management choose to organize production and control secure workers' commitment, both in the factory as well as in the local communities? So doing field work. I'm still in the field work stage, and I complete two sites last summer and also this past fall. So I'm still having I'm still working on the remaining three factories. So hopefully I will get the field work done and also the book, the draft ready in the next, I would consider maybe 2 or 3 years.
Wow. Yeah. Well, best of luck with that work. And thanks again for making time, Lou. It was a pleasure and congratulations on a great book.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed. Thank you.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks for listening and we'll see you next time.